will be Marriage of Kay.
Isn't it Stark?
Oh, I have one. I'm sorry, I might have the wrong case. Hang on just a second. Yeah, you're right. I have the wrong one. Okay, next case. I'm sorry.
That's rare.
Stock versus McLeod.
If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. May it please the Court, Jamie Ellison on behalf of Appellant Stock & Associates, Incorporated. Stock & Associates is a local architectural firm, design professional that had done some previous projects with the developer, in this case, the respondent, Stuart McLeod of McLeod Development. On the particular project at issue, there were long delays when they were attempting to negotiate a contract, the initial delays.
Mr. Ellison, I appreciate your wanting to summarize the facts, but the panel is very familiar with the facts. There are two essential challenges here, one to the trial court's failure to give an implied in fact instruction, you call it quantum merit, and second of all, it's really not clear what the second of all is, whether it's an evidentiary challenge, but it obviously relates to the trial court's rulings on the counterclaim. I understand the argument, and the record's pretty clear about whether or not you preserved, and I understand you were trial counsel, preserved the trial court's failure to give the instruction, but I want to get a little more pointed about that. Because from that you argue that somehow the ruling on the counterclaim and the admission of evidence somehow tainted your first claim. Isn't it true though that the plaintiffs did get a correctly stated instruction that you proposed that allowed them to argue quantum merit? And I'm talking about. It looks like the one that you proposed from the American Bar Association model jury instructions, and it's reflected in the instruction number 12. Would you comment on that, please? And in particular, the third sentence, which appears to mirror the Young statement of what the elements are for an implied in fact.
If you could read the third sentence for my benefit there, because the proposed instruction.
So instruction number 12 proposed and adopted by the court by the plaintiff was, if you find, let me read the whole thing so it's in context, if you find that extra work was requested or authorized by the owner, and if you find that there was an agreement between the parties as to the price to be paid for such extras, then the contractor is entitled to receive the agreed price. If the extra work, which is the ASR, that's what you folks call it, was requested or authorized by the owner and there was no agreement about price, then the contractor is entitled to be paid the reasonable value of the work. And the last one, just to be complete, if you find that extra work was not required or authorized by the owner, then the contractor is not entitled to be paid for the extra work. Now, this sounds like it gave you the opportunity to argue precisely what you're alleging you were denied by the court's failure to give your, assuming that you properly preserved it, your quantum merit argument.
Right. There were two specific instructions, one for quasi-contract that was coupled with a quantum merit remedy that gave the language that even if the parties did not reach an agreement, and I understand why you're asking that question based on what's in the middle of that, and clearly the panel has done its research because I don't recall this being a part of the briefing on either side.
It's actually an instruction you proposed and trial court gave. I assume you argued this. I mean, in fact, it seems that the one that you are complaining that the trial court didn't give is a much more onerous standard than the one you actually got.
Your Honor, in full candor, I don't recall that one actually being read to the jury in the full form that you just read it. If that's what the record reflects, then I can't say anything about that. But I don't recall that one actually being read to the jury in the form that you read it. What I recall clearly is that the proposed instructions on quasi-contract and quantum merit were not included in the packet. There was no...
Assume that the record reflects what Judge Lau believes it reflects. Then answer her question.
Thank you, Your Honor. The start of that instruction is still emphasizing whether or not the parties have a contract. Which was the respondent's theory of the case, that there was a contract, and if there's any damages, they can only arise from the contract. Appellant's theory of the case was either there was a contract or there was not, but in either case, they were entitled to damages. The second part of the instruction, in full candor, is troubling for the argument that we pressed on the appeal. When I heard you read it back,
just to be fair to you, it's CP 379. It's the packet of instruction, court's instructions to the jury, dated November 5th, 2012. It's signed by Judge Heller, and it's the original, and it's instruction number 12. That's what it says.
There were several proposed sets, and the only thing that I'm going to be able to do on that is check to see if that's the one that was actually read to the jury.
It's the one that was filed in the court file, too, is the original instructions. If I'm wrong, I'm happy to be corrected, but
understood.
I think I'm right.
Understood, and you may be, Your Honor. You may be.
You might want to address that second issue.
The second issue was an issue that was raised in pretrial motion, because we knew it was coming, that respondent wanted to say, hey, appellant hasn't paid certain sub consultants because we paid them ourselves. It was a voluntary payment issue. It never should have gone before the jury. It was presented just to try to taint Stock and Associates as someone who wasn't paying their debts. Eventually, the trial court agreed with that and agreed it shouldn't have gone to the jury. But by the time he made that change and vacated the judgment on that, it was too late. It already had gone to the jury.
How did it taint the jury?
You can answer that question.
In two ways. One, it focused their attention again on the theory of the case that this is all about whether a contract was executed when the contract wasn't executed, and it painted Stock and Associates as someone who wasn't paying their debts, which was untrue. They were someone who did pay their debts.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Chris Brain representing the respondent, McLeod. This is a case where there was a contract, and I think that's where we get to instruction number 12 and why the court gave that instruction. And indeed, counsel in page one of his brief, admits that there was a contract for a certain scope of work and a fixed fee for that scope of work. What we're dealing in this case was, were there extras, and did you have notice of those extras? And in our position, the contract was formed. Yes, there was not a B-151 signed, but the contract was the detailed breakdown of the $1.41 million and the 10-page detailed scope of work. Those were prepared by Stock and Associates. There's one more document, which is a written document, which I believe also forms that contract, and that's Exhibit 204. And that one was the document where a number of things were said, but the most important thing was said was, I will give you notice if there are any issues with related to the contract price or contract issues or extra work. And so we proceeded forward. The parties did not execute a written contract. But as we all know, oral contracts are first of all enforceable, but second of all, you have the material terms of this contract being actually documented in writing by detailed documents. Now, what happens after that? What happens after that, and this is the first part of that instruction, is that They bill consistently, monthly, to Attachment A and Exhibit B, which are the fee and the specific scope of work. And they bill on a percentage of completion. They give us a detailed narrative of what's going on, what's happening, how far they are as far as each phase of it. And this happens through 82% of the job. Now, at that point in time, what happens is the economy starts to crater, and so the job was stopped. But if you look at the exhibits, and I'm going to say Exhibit 212 is the first billing statement that was made on a percentage of the completion, and they call it the main contract, and then they show the percentage of completion and the amount of work. On the remaining exhibits up until a year later, in September, remember this contract started October 1 of 2005, a year later, what they do is they say that it's a claim for ASR. Well, what is an ASR? An ASR is additional service request. What's an additional service request? It's something over an existing contract, which from there on, from September 24th on all of the ASRs, they call the base contract. So what happened at trial was, and what they asserted was, yes, we had a base contract. It was this scope of work and this fee. But we did work outside that scope.
The jury heard all of that evidence.
They heard all of that evidence,
Your
Honor.
Can you address, because your time is limited.
I know.
Would you please address the jury instruction that appears to allow him to make his argument about, we don't have a contract for the ASRs, but under a theory of implied contract implied in fact, where the judge erred by not giving us the instruction, but it seems that instruction 12 allows them to do precisely that.
It does.
That.
And see, Your Honor, we didn't contest that if these ASRs were within the scope, that the amount they were billing would have been reasonable. That's not the issue that was there. The question was whether they were given notice of those before they were performed and whether they were in the scope of work. The quantum merit instruction that he wanted at the beginning of the trial but never took exception to when it wasn't given was to basically say there was no underlying contract. And therefore, what he wanted was a quantum merit as to the entire scope of work. And that's where you get into the Chandler case, and that Chandler is the Chandler versus Washington State Toll Bridge Authority. And this is why quantum merit as to the entire claim is not relevant.
Well, when you say entire claim, we're just talking about the ASRs.
The ASRs, he had the opportunity and did argue that they were outside the scope of work and they were entitled to that compensation, which is exactly what that instruction says.
And that's really the heart of what he's talking about now and that he's complaining about. He didn't get his instruction to allow him to argue the ASRs were outside the agreement and therefore based on quantum merit, I'm entitled to get the reasonable value.
No, that's not correct. What he was arguing is I get my reasonable value because there was no contract.
Isn't that what I just said?
No, because you're saying as to the ASRs. He's saying there was no contract as to the entire job. And that's the problem with the instruction that he proposed, but never objected to or raised an exception to when it wasn't provided. What he basically did is he got the opportunity, that instruction does exactly what the case was saying. If you find...
But your client paid, if that's the case, your client paid him pursuant to the contract.
Correct.
So if there was a dispute about whether or not he was entitled to get paid at all based on the contract, I guess I'm confused.
Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem. Again, the contract was for a scope of work and a fixed fee. All right, we start
right
there. So the issue, and we went through the detailed facts, just giving you examples on the first three SRs, which were 85-90% of the dollar value claimed. They were all within the scope of work for the contract that was agreed to. All right? he got to argue that issue, and he got to put evidence on. I mean, he tried to put evidence on that we'd had notice of them, but there was no evidence that we did. In fact, his clients testified that they never gave notice. And then he tried to show that they were outside the scope.
Mr. Green, can I just...
Go ahead.
We're really running out of time. Do you agree or not that Instruction 12 gave him the opportunity to argue quantum merit?
I agree it did.
Okay. Can you address his second assignment of error based on the counterclaim, which the court struck?
Yes.
They're saying you guys argue bad actor and what a bum these people were, blah, 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 blah.
No.
Essentially what the brief says.
Well, first of all, understand that at trial, that's Exhibit 256, at trial, and the scenario was this. He had made a motion in limine prior to trial to dismiss the counterclaim and all evidence related to it. The court denied that and said, look, I'm going to let this stuff come in and see what there is. At trial, Exhibit 256 had a cover letter to it, and that cover letter was a letter from the engineering firm saying, do not pursue this claim. We've released this claim. We're not asking you for any money, and you're released. He objected to the exhibit. We had a sidebar, and this is at in the record. And after the sidebar, we redacted that cover letter. So then the next thing that happens is I offer the exhibit, and that's where, in our brief, we state, I said, move for admission. Any objection? And Mr. Ellison said, not to that document, Your Honor, and the reason for it was is we'd taken away the objectionable part. So he never objected to the admission of the settlement agreement. Now, the settlement agreement was relevant for more than just the counterclaim. My client had paid $25,000 to resolve an outstanding engineering bill. He planned to go forward with this project. It was relevant because, number one, they were claiming 100% of the PSM fees. Well, we paid 25% of that. So it went to the issue of damages. You haven't been damaged because we paid part of that claim. So as a practical matter, there was no prejudice there. And to the extent that the counterclaim was there, the court cured it by reversing the judgment on the counterclaim. It's cured. And again, he didn't object.
How did it play out any different in terms of what the jury heard than if the jury had just found against the counterclaim, rather than the judge substituting the judge's opinion for the jury's verdict? If the jury had just not credited it, would there have been any difference?
No, wouldn't have been any difference, Your Honor.
So it's just the manner in which the claim was dismissed.
The manner in which the claim was dismissed. And again, if the evidence was not objected to and it was relevant for other purposes, the jury could listen to that evidence, and they were given an instruction on the counterclaim, and they didn't have to believe it, and they could have denied it. And the court, as we indicated, cured it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Correct, Your Honor. Judge Lau, you had correctly summarized our position. The only claims being pursued were for the ASRs. Those are the only damage items quantified. So when it came to the question of whether it was by contract or implied in fact, it wasn't throw out the whole thing. It was, as you summarized, it was for the ASRs. With regard to jury instruction 12, the later part of the instruction found no companion on the special verdict form. Even if the jury was given that language, there was nothing they could do with it because the special verdict form just asked if they found a breach of contract. In the earlier versions,
they said no. If you put the special verdict, there were some questions that they asked. The first question they answered, no, there's no breach of contract. If
Correct.
There's no breach of contract, how do you get damages for ASR? You do it under a theory that instruction number 12 allowed them to do, and that is your quantum merit.
Those questions weren't included on the special verdict form that would have allowed them to.
Well, they didn't need a question. Because they say there's no contract breach, which they did, then they just follow through, read instruction 12 and the other instructions that allow them to award damages if there is no formal written contract.
Correct, but that was only one theory of the case, if there was no formal written contract. The jury was never asked on the verdict form, even if there is, regardless of your answer to that question, even if there is no formal written contract, do you find that there was a quasi-contract or contract implied in fact? Those the judge was asked to make that determination, and when the determination wasn't made, those jury instructions were proposed, and that was the quantum merit instruction. It was the quantum merit remedy for the quasi-contract breach. The jury was never asked that question. The language in jury instruction number 12 might have informed them of that, but they were never given a chance to answer it because the verdict form just asked the question you just recited. Did they breach the contract? And that doesn't answer the other theory of the case, which they never had a chance to get a decision from the jury.
But the jury did award your client $9,000-something. You say the other side conceded it. I'm not sure that's a precise characterization.
They did. They disputed it up until the time of trial. So for a couple of years, it was disputed. But during trial, Mr. McLeod on the stand did say that I received notice for that one, and that one would be valid. It was a concession at trial. My time is up.
Thank you.